pioneering farm in the legal growing of cannabis.
I had never seen a live cannabis plant before. That, to me, was when I first got to the farm and I saw, as a photographer, how beautiful the plants were and the variety of the different colors and the formations of the buds and the plants and the leaves. They're all different. They're all unique. So visually, it was a stunning story to tell. So as a photographer, I approach it from the pictures first. But while I was there living with them in their farmhouse over a Corona beer with Ben and a Hindu Kush joint, I got the story out of them. It was fun. It was a fun project to work on, this book. It really was. I discovered a lot about my family, and I also discovered a lot about this new frontier in American agriculture, which is, and these are the pioneers. You know, it's in my own family, which is really cool. And I thought, this is an opportunity. I had to do it now. It had to be done while it was new, while it was happening. I said, because this era is going to be gone, and this is going to be looked back on as, you know, a revolution in American agriculture, I believe.
That's David Goodman. We talk with him about his book, An American Cannabis Story. Illustrated with stunning photographs, it's about a pioneering cannabis farm in Washington State. Then we replay our 2021 interview with neuroscientist Carl Hart about his book, Drug Use for Grown-Ups, Chasing Liberty in the Land of Fear. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Marijuana legalization in many states, with more being added all the time, has turned cannabis farming from a hidden activity into a legitimate and burgeoning business. One of the early pioneers is Puffin Farm in Washington State. Started by Jade Stefano and Ben Short, the farm grows all its product outdoors according to the principles of organic and regenerative agriculture. When photographer David Goodman went to Puffin Farm to visit Jade, who's his niece, he was blown away by the beauty of the cannabis plants they were growing. As he learned more about the farm, he decided to put his photography skills to work to show us the new world of cannabis farming in words and pictures through the story of Puffin Farm. An American Cannabis Story takes the reader behind the scenes, showing how Jade and Ben grow and process top-quality cannabis, what the entourage effect is, and why the amount of THC or CBD isn't as important as we think. David Goodman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
This was really a delightful book to read. I will confess I do a little bit of personal growing of my own.
Oh, that's really interesting.
I think we're allowed to do that in New York State now.
It's totally legal.
So now this chronicles a year in the life of Puffin Farm, which was one of the first licensed cannabis farms in the United States. It's a family operation. And when I say family, I mean you're related to it as well.
Exactly.
How did Puffin Farm come about?
Well, of course, that's all documented in the book, but it was a fascinating story. In fact, it was fascinating to me to learn because obviously I've known my niece all her life. So when I heard she was opening up the farm and I went out there, of course, I had to go see it. I had to go take pictures. And when I got out there, I was so fascinated by it that it ended up becoming not just a year study, but it was going on almost four years that I kept going out there to photograph different things. And during the pandemic, as the production of the book got pushed off and got delayed, it gave me more of an opportunity to get even more material to put into the book. So I was happy for that, not for the pandemic, but for the fact that I actually had more time to further research and get more material for the book, which it's all in the book. But how did it come about? So I found this out actually while I was going out there shooting, because I knew Jade and Ben. You know, they were married and they were a happy couple, and they were into this farming thing. But I didn't know that they met when they were teenagers. you know, they met in high school. And that's really where it started. So, okay, they like to go out behind the gym and smoke a joint together. But it turned into a passion for them where they wanted to learn everything about farming techniques. And they picked up all the handbooks that taught them how to grow. And after a while, they found their own ways of growing and of nurturing the soil. And they're really fanatics about reversing climate change and how farming can play a major role in doing that. And they're incredible examples of that. So little by little, my brother Cliff started the whole migration west. We're an East Coast family. And Cliff is a glass blower, really talented glass blower. And he owns the Seattle Glass Blowing Studio, which is one of the major glass blowing forces in Seattle, which is a glass blowing center. And my nieces, Jade and Serena, both, you know, were hanging out with Cliff. They wanted to go visit him. And they just loved it there. So they ended up going to school there. Jade ended up working for Cliff at his glass blowing studio, and Serena did too. And when it became legal for them to grow under the medical marijuana system, which was a whole different set of laws, which is now history since the new regulations came into being in 2014. And they got really good at it. And they started growing under the medical marijuana system. And then when it came, I-502 passed in 2012, I think it was, but it came into force in 2014, and they were right there. You know, they got their farm ready, they applied for their license, they got approved, and they opened Puffin Farm. But there was a lot of, as you know, you read the book, there's a lot of roadblocks in the way for them to get to that point. And they were incredible how they just, all four of them got together. So it's my two nieces, Jade and Serena, my niece's husband, Ben. Jade and Ben, they're basically the protagonist of the book. And then my brother, Cliff, who came into it, you know, they needed financial backing, and Cliff's a very successful businessman. So so it's a whole family thing, and they all have their individual roles. And it was a great thing to watch. It was a great thing to discover, it's something that was so interesting for me to learn. And then when I started writing it and showing it to some of my friends, they're going, really kind of interesting. I've never seen a farm before. I had never seen a live cannabis plant before. That to me was when I first got to the farm and I saw, as a photographer, how beautiful the plants were and the variety of the different colors and the formations of the buds and the plants and the leaves. They're all different. They're all unique. So visually, it was a stunning story to tell. So as a photographer, I approach it from the pictures first. But while I was there living with them in their farmhouse over a Corona beer with Ben and a Hindu Kush joint, I got the story out of them of how they met, how they got into the farming technique. And I just took notes. I recorded it all. I did a lot of time transposing it and then looking at it and distilling it and re-editing it until I got to the essence of the story. And it was fun. It was a fun project to work on, this book. It really was. I discovered a lot about my family, and I also discovered a lot about this new frontier in American agriculture, which is, and these are the pioneers. You know, it's in my own family, which is really cool. And I thought, this is an opportunity. I had to do it now. It had to be done while it was new, while it was happening. I said, because this era is going to be gone, and this is going to be looked back on as, you know, a revolution in American agriculture, I believe.
Well, it is really a fun book to read. So I can imagine how much fun, even more fun, it was to write. You mentioned Hindu Kush. I mean, I had to say my jaw dropped when I saw that they are the originators of the strains Hindu Kush and Lemon OG, which for those of my listeners who do partake of weed, know are probably two of the most popular strains around. So you mentioned agriculture, an agricultural revolution. I mean, they're really part of a much larger agricultural revolution that's far more than just cultivating cannabis. It is really all about regenerative agriculture.
Exactly.
So talk about their approach. I mean, for one thing, they grow about 1,500 plants outside, not inside. So first tell us, why did they decide to do an outside grow, not an inside grow? What's the difference between them in terms of, you know, the plant itself?
Well, first and foremost, and most apparently, it's a plant. Plants grow outside, and you have to go back and you have to look at why are people growing it indoors to begin with anyway? The only reason was they had to hide it. And when you grow indoors, you're using a huge amount of electricity. I think Jade said it was like 5% of Washington State electricity. The exact figures are in the book, which is a huge amount just for cannabis, for growing it indoors. But you also cannot duplicate the power of the sun. You know, it's just not the same thing. And you can't duplicate through growing out in the open field. When you grow indoors also, you have more problems with pests. And in order to control them, people use a lot of chemical pesticides. When you grow in an organic manner, the way Jade and Ben do on Puffin Farm, there is a whole natural pest control with, there's ladybugs and there's mantises and there's birds that eat all the bad bugs. And they use things like neem oil, which is an organic pesticide and doesn't harm the plant. And it's harmless to humans. So there's ways of farming where you don't have to use chemicals. And that's obviously the best way. Jade will tell you, and it's in the book, that it's also, there's something about the wind blowing through the plants, which change the way the different flavors are expressed and the different effects take place. The wind, the amount of sun you get, the UV rays you get, the type of water, the type of soil that you have, all affects how the plant comes out in terms of quality. And they have an incredible terroir.
So say what that is.
Terroir is everything that goes into your plant, everything that feeds the plant. They use that word a lot in cultivating grapes for wine. It's the type of soil that you have, the type of water, how it's irrigated, the type of, the amount of sunlight, the elevation. Everything goes into how the plant is expressed, the final quality of the plant. And that's what terroir is. So a lot of people who grow indoors will tell you that you can have more control. And that could be true because, you know, to a certain degree, when you're growing outdoors, like any farm, you're subject to what is the weather this year? Is it a dry year? Do you have enough water? Is it too hot? They had a very hot summer a couple of years ago and the plants didn't grow very big. So it affected their yield. They didn't get as much product out of it that year.
Yeah. And how did they deal with that? Because that was beyond record-breaking heat, as a matter of fact. I mean, it was off the charts. In fact, I was speaking about it recently with author Jeff Goodell, who just came out with a book called The Heat Will Kill You First.
I listened to that podcast, by the way. It was fascinating. You know, they use drip irrigation, so that the plants are constantly being watered in a very slow drip level, which conserves water, but it also gives the plants water on a regular basis. So they're constantly getting enough water. And I don't know what it's like this year for them, you know, because it's still July. So August, September, they still have until October before harvest. So, you know, it could end up being a really record-breaking heat this summer. And that's what it looks like it's going to be. So it's not great. And that's the thing also. People hear, oh, they got a pot farm. They must be rolling it. They must be... It is a farm and it's subject to everything that any farm is subject to. So, you know, you can have great years and you can have not so great years, but, you know, they seem to be coming out with a terrific product consistently and they're winning a lot of awards for it. So it's, you know, it's, they're doing a good job there.
So you talk in the book, David Goodman, you talk in An American Cannabis Story about how they build the soil microbiome, how they see that soil as a carbon sink. And you talk a lot about something called terpenes. Tell us about terpenes. This was really a fascinating part of the book for me. I mean, I knew that, you know, terpenes are the operative principle in many ways, but a lot of people don't. A lot of people think it's all about THC and CBD. They don't know about terpenes. So tell us about that and explode the myth of high THC.
Well, that is probably the question of the main, most important subject in the book. And like you said, most people hadn't heard of terpenes. I'm one of those people. I didn't know what it was. And I remember I was in the farmhouse with Jade, and I was in the kitchen, and all of a sudden she starts talking about terpenes, and I'm like, as if I knew what she was talking about, right? And I'm like, I say, wait, stop. What are you talking about? What is this terpene thing? And she says, terpenes, that's what we do. It's the most important thing. I said, are you serious? I said, what about THC and what about growing? I thought you're growing weed. She says, we are essentially terpene farmers. Terpenes are the chemicals that are in every fruit, every vegetable that give it its distinctive aroma. So in a lemon peel, when you scratch a lemon peel and you know that distinctive smell that you get from a lemon or a tangerine, those are terpenes. Same thing with anything that you can think of, you know, a peach, certain spices, garlic, pepper, they all have a certain aroma. And those are the terpenes that create that. Well, there are terpenes in cannabis, in addition to the cannabinoids, which, of course, we know of as THC. The primary ones are THC and CBD. There's also some other ones, but those are the main ones. Terpenes come into the chemical profile of a specific cannabis plant in various ways. And there's all sorts of terpenes. There's hundreds of them. And not every cannabis plant has every terpene. Some are dominant in some, and recessive in others, and some they have none, and other cannabis strains will have it in abundance. And that brings us to the most important concept, I believe, in the book, called the entourage effect. And that is a concept that was popularized by Dr. Ethan Russo. One of the major gets for my book was to get an interview with this real pioneer in the human endocannabinoid system and in cannabis in general. Especially in its therapeutic use. And Ethan Russo didn't invent it, but he popularized it, and he really embraced the idea of the entourage effect. And that is that everything in the cannabis plant, all the terpenoids and all the cannabinoids work together to create a specific effect and to create a specific aroma, because it all has to do with aroma. And this has been proven in the past, like 20 or so years since the theory was first developed. So it's all about terpenes. And the whole idea is to get people who read the book to pay attention to the terpene content, because that's what will change the effect, not whether it's a sativa or an indica, which is an old wives' tale that sativa will always produce a certain up effect and an indica will produce a relaxed, low-key effect. We explode that myth in the book, and Dr. Russo also contributed to that chapter in a big way. He really clarifies it for me and certainly for the readers, I believe. So that's what terpenes are, and that's how important they are, and that's what this book is about. And thank you, Jade, for illuminating me to that. And I think everyone I know who's read it, who's listened to it, was unaware of what terpenes are and what they do. All they cared about was THC. How much THC? Wow, high THC. You know, there's one strain that Ben talks about in the book. It's got low THC. They can't sell it. And it's like 13% THC. And nobody wants to look at you if it's under 18 or 20%. And I said to him, why do you grow it if you can't sell it? He says, because we love it. He said, it is such a yummy strain. People are fooled by the 13%, because whatever the terpene content is, he says you get just as good a feeling from that as from other strains, but even more special in its own way. But no one will discover that strain because they can't sell it to dispensaries. 13%, they say, I don't want that. We need really high. They only want high. Not everybody wants it that high anyway, you know?
Yeah, in fact, 13% is pretty high. I think, you know, back in when I was a college student, it was more like 5 or 6%. And in fact, you point out in the book, and this was interesting to me because I've had this experience, high THC can cause a rapid heartbeat, which can be actually quite dangerous for people. And I have had that experience. In fact, I had to go to the hospital once because of it. And say more about the terpenes. You have a story in the book about a young girl named River who suffered from a disease that caused seizures, epileptic seizures. And she discovered that, or her father, parents discovered that the oil made from one strain was effective, but not from another strain. And these were high CBD. I mean, CBD is what is supposed to be effective with epilepsy. So tell us a story of River.
Well, the story of River is the story of a father's love. John Barclay was a total hero to his daughter, and he totally was, you know, out there fighting tooth and nail to get the treatment that his daughter needed. It's hard for me to go into this story without tearing up. You know, every time I read the chapter, it just does that to me because so River has this disease called Batten disease, and it's a rare inherited disorder of the nervous system, and it mostly strikes very young children. It's always fatal. River lived a lot longer than she was ever predicted, you know, and I think it's due to her father's care and the way he, you know, just really loved her into life. But she was getting intractable seizures, like multiple. I can't even fathom the idea of like more than 20 seizures a day, and nothing was helping her. He tried all sorts of pharmaceuticals. He says there are 26, something like 26 pharmaceuticals to treat epilepsy. He says, and none of them, here's the quote, I just found it. There are 26 pharmaceutical drugs on the market used to treat epilepsy, and not one of them can help my daughter, and some of them do actual physical harm to her. But the remedy worked like a charm. So remedy just happens to be the name. It's a remedy, right? But it happens to be the name of a strain of CBD grown by Puffin Farm. And somehow he came upon it. John had been giving her tinctures of CBD, which, you know, worked at first, but they were very weak. And after a while, she built up a tolerance and it didn't help her anymore. So he had to like give her gobs and gobs of the oil in order to get it to work. But then he discovered this remedy flower. I don't know why he picked the remedy. He was somehow drawn to it and he extracted it. He learned how to make his own extractions. And he would put it in, I think he said he put it in a cookie or he put it in her oatmeal. And he figured out the dose. And as long as he gave her the extractions and she had her cookie or her oatmeal, there were zero seizures. It stopped it. So he tracked it down. He found out from the dispensary that he got it from, that they had several ounces of it. And he said, please put it on hold for me. I'll buy it. You know, and they did that. It was really great. And it worked. Until they ran out. And then somehow he tracked down another dispensary right near where Puffin Farm was. And they had 2 ounces, one of remedy. And they said, well, we have this other Puffin Farm product called Dance Hall, which is one of the original CBD strains. And it's very popular on its own. I mean, Dance Hall is really good for anxiety. And a lot of people take it to help them sleep. Serena. It's the only strain she uses. She uses it, she says, to stay grounded. It helps her stay grounded. Not a THC, not euphoriant. It doesn't get you high, but it does sort of like something else psychologically, which helps a lot of people with depression and anxiety and just staying focused in Serena's case. But somehow he used the remedy first and he extracted that. He gave it to River and it worked. And then he extracted the Dance Hall. I guess he figured it's also a CBD strain from Puffin Farm. But it didn't work. The Dance Hall did not work. The bottom line is he found more remedy. He got in touch. He finally got through to Jaden Ben and they set him up and he was able to grow his own remedy and they gave him some plants and he loved them, you know, for that. And that was great. You know, so River was getting her medicine. But why did the remedy work? And why did the Dance Hall not work? They both had almost the same level of CBD. So it can't be the CBD. The CBD levels were the same. They had different terpene content. And Jade's feeling is she thinks it's the alpha pinene, or I think it was the alpha or beta pinene that was in the remedy that helped her. But, you know, we're not going to know any of this stuff until it becomes federally legal and until we can start using federal dollars for research. You know, we are now really low down in pioneering of medical research in cannabis.
Well, this is an important issue because if it is not legal federally, there is a prohibition actually on doing this kind of research. Now, is that prohibition, does it mean you can't do it in the states, or is it just a question of you can't access the kind of money that's necessary?
I think it's probably, I don't know. I'm not really up on the laws, but it seems to me that if it's federally illegal, then you could possibly risk getting in trouble as a researcher to do something on that. Maybe in your state, it would be okay to do it. I'm really not up on that. No, I know that there's research being done because Ethan Russo is doing it, but he's in Washington State. I mean, we're way behind country. Well, Israel obviously is number one, but we're way behind countries like Uruguay, Czech Republic. Canada is really way up there in terms of research. We're behind, obviously, the Netherlands, but we're behind Spain. I mean, we're not. We should be number one.
So, David Goodman, talk about the indica and sativa myth. This was another thing that was totally new to me. So a lot of people think that indica gives you that kind of mellow, you know, couch lock high, and sativa is good for, concentration, and it's more energetic. You say that's a complete myth.
Well, I think probably the best way to do that is maybe just read that short chapter, because it's only a few paragraphs long and it just blows it right up. Jade and Ben really turned me on to this idea, but it became really clear when I had my conversation with Dr. Russo, because, you know, he's so succinct. And I always go back to the chapter, his chapter in the book, because it's mostly his words. And he's so enlightening in that chapter. But in this chapter, he talks about the difference between indica and sativa. And he just says, it just has no meaning. Blowing up the indica sativa myth, because it is a myth. Are you an indica person or are you a sativa person? Do you enjoy a strain that has a relaxing, mellow, quote unquote, buzzed effect? Or do you prefer cannabis that gives you an up, energetic, creative feeling? But wait a minute. Can you actually tell the difference between an indica and a sativa cultivar? For years, we've heard that the way to distinguish between indica and sativa plants is by the way they grow and the shape of their leaves. That indica plants are short and bushy and their fan leaves broad, while sativa plants grow lean and tall and their fan leaves are long and narrow. We've also been told that these two so-called major types of cannabis will produce predictably different effects, that indica strains produce a more relaxing and sedating body sensation, or what might be called a classically stoned feeling. Conversely, sativa strains are supposed to produce an energetic cerebral high, the type often credited with bringing out mental clarity and creativity. Well, guess what? Jade and Ben say that's all pretty much malarkey, and to toss those ideas out right now. They're among a small but growing number of cannabis experts who understand that the best way to predict how a specific cultivar might react in the body is through testing and studying the chemical profiles, the chemotypes of each plant. Jade says there is so much variety in the terpenoid and cannabinoid profiles between most of our cultivars that you simply cannot say that any particular strain will always create the expected effect based merely on whether it is an indica or sativa. Dr. Russo agrees. He tells me there are biochemically distinct strains of cannabis, but the sativa-indica distinction as commonly applied in the lay literature is total nonsense and an exercise in futility. One cannot in any way currently guess the biochemical content of a given cannabis plant based on its height, branching, or leaf morphology. The terms indica and sativa, they're totally inaccurate, the way they're applied these days. What was initially described as cannabis indica by Jean-Baptiste Lamarck in the 18th century is a plant that doesn't look like what people commonly call indica today. Plus, these names reflect nothing about the biochemical content of the plant. Rather, what we really need are the cannabinoid and terpenoid profiles to distinguish one plant from another. I feel that the terms indica and sativa have no meaning at this point. This is science. I am not going to use inaccurate slang to describe something that science has clearly established. That's from Dr. Russo. So, yeah, you know, there's the authority for me.
And of course, in a product like this, myths abound. And I think one of the, you know, really delightful aspects of your book is that it shows how one can kind of get back to basics with a product of this kind and do good, grow something that's quite beautiful, and do it in a way that it was meant to be. So finally, tell us about the trifecta. This is a product that was invented by Puffin Farm?
I don't know that they invented it, but I've never seen a version that's as good as theirs because of the way they grow their weed and because of the way they make their extracts. So, yeah, okay, so trifecta. Imagine a pre-roll joint you know, those little like torpedo shaped joints that they make now, not like the way we used to roll them. But and then they there's a product called hash rosin, or maybe it's the flower rosin they use. So they use the rosin, which they warm up so it liquefies better, and they paint it on the joint with a brush. And then before that dries, or that immediately, they roll it in bubble hash, which is basically a form of granulated keef, which comes from the dry trichomes of the plant. So yeah, it's a trifecta. So it's got a regular joint plus rosin plus hash, rolled in hash. So you got the three things. And it definitely packs a punch. It's not for the inexperienced user. Or if it is, just one hit is enough. But it's an ooey gooey, very full of terpenes, very terpene rich, delicious, yummy type of a joint. And it's good to bring to a party. I'd recommend it for everyday use, but it's a good special, I don't know, I guess if you're used to it, a special occasion type of treat. And they're pretty to look at too.
David Goodman is a photographer in New York City. His work has appeared in print and online publications like the New York Times, Vogue magazine, and Huffington Post. His most recent New York City gallery show featured his photo series on Manhattan's Highline Park. And you can see him talk about his new series of cannabis photos on Canvas at writersvoice.net. Next up, drug use for grown-ups. Stick around. Back in May of 2021, we spoke with neuroscientist and professor Carl Hart about his book, Drug Use for Grown-Ups. Here's an abridged version of that conversation.
I am an unapologetic drug user. I take drugs as a part of my pursuit of happiness, and they work. I am a happier and better person because of them. I am also a scientist and a professor of psychology, specializing in neuroscience at Columbia University, known for my work on drug abuse and addiction. It has taken me more than 2 decades to come out of the closet about my personal drug use. Simply put, I have been a coward.
That's Carl Hart reading from his book, Drug Use for Grown-Ups. Judging from the reaction to his book, it took an extraordinary amount of courage for him to come out about his recreational use of drugs. He's had to endure outrage and disbelief at his suggestion that drugs, from cannabis to heroin and cocaine, can be used responsibly by adults without physical or psychological harm, much less addiction. Yet Hart comes to his position through decades of respected research into drugs and their impact on human health. He's a professor of psychology in the departments of psychology and psychiatry at Columbia University. He's also a research scientist at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. Dr. Hart has published numerous scientific and popular articles in the area of neuropsychopharmacology and is the co-author of the textbook Drugs, Society, and Human Behavior. So if anyone has the credentials to say drugs can be used responsibly, it's Carl Hart. Far more dangerous than the use of drugs, Hart maintains, is the war on drugs, which has resulted in the mass incarceration of millions of our citizens, disproportionately people of color. Drug use for grown-ups is not only an impeccably laid out scientific case for legalizing drugs, it's a passionate critique of the institutional groupthink that condemns them and the racist injustice system of the war on drugs. Well, Carl Hart, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book, Drug Use for Grown-Ups, you clearly state in the first sentence that it is not a book promoting drug use. Yet I've watched other interviews that you've had, and I've seen your frustration sometimes when the interviewers keep seeming to imply that that's exactly what you're doing. So just so we get that out of the way, what's this book for, and who is this book for?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. This book is really a book that is trying to highlight our hypocrisy in terms of our drug policy
and in terms of how we're enforcing our drug laws. And I'm trying to show people what the tremendous costs are to our current practices and how our current practices are inconsistent with the original promise of the country, that is, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for its citizens.
You know, it seems to me that people have a hard time wrapping their minds around the idea that there's more than just either condemning drugs or promoting them. I want to get back to this idea of the pursuit of happiness, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But before we go further, you're a neuroscientist, you're a professor of neuroscience and psychology at Columbia University. Just briefly tell our listeners a bit about your work, your research in this area, so we get a sense of the background and the knowledge that you bring to this.
Yeah, for more than 30 years, I have been studying the effects of drugs on the human brain, on animals, and just on behavior. And so what that means is that I bring people into the lab and I give them various drugs like cocaine, methamphetamine, marijuana, and I carefully study their effects long after the drug is over, the immediate effects of the drugs, in an effort to help us understand what drugs do and what drugs don't do.
You've traveled a long way since you first started 30 years ago. Talk a little bit about that trajectory that you traveled.
Yeah, when I first started studying drugs in the late 80s, early 90s, my ideas were that drugs were bad. And I thought that if I could understand the brain better, I would be able to understand drug addiction treatment better. And maybe I could come up with cures that would help people who were struggling with drug addiction, because I believed at the time drugs were destroying the communities from which I came. These communities were resource poor, oftentimes shut out of the American dream. And I thought this was all occurring because of drug addiction or the drug trade. But over the time that I have been studying drugs, I've come to realize that I was wrong. And there were certainly other factors that were involved in those communities not doing well. Factors like lack of employment, lack of opportunities, poor education, isolation, racial discrimination. All of these things were at play, but I blame drugs for the problems that I saw. But like you would expect, over a long career, you hope that people figure things out and you hope that they use data, evidence to support their positions that they arrive at.
Well, you're unusual in this field. Why do you think that so many scientists have persisted with a kind of groupthink around drugs?
I think that there are several reasons that occurs. I think, number one, it's difficult to go against convention because then you're isolated, you're on your own, and you come up against a lot of opposition when you don't have to if you have the position that everyone else has. Another reason, I think a number of scientists choose not to take this position or be as vocal about this position is because we have to understand that science, most scientists come from middle-class white families in the United States. And those communities have not been as affected by what we thought were drug problems. And those communities have not paid the price in terms of high incarceration rates. And so I have this added pressure to think about what has been the cost of our current drug policies on my communities, on people who live in those communities. And so all of these sorts of things force me to really reckon with these issues on a regular basis. And I don't think other scientists bump up against this in their daily lives like I do.
Yeah, you know, Carl Hart, in this book, Drug Use for Grownups, I mean, what you've just said and in the whole book, you really weave together a narrative of science, of policy, but also of racism and the history of racism as it impacts the development of policy. I mean, like so much else, it seems like our attitudes towards drugs in this country seem distorted by racism and our racial narratives.
Yeah, the documentary filmmaker Kim Burns once said that no matter what endeavor you're looking at in this country, if you're not looking at race, then you're probably missing the mark. Of course, I'm paraphrasing. And drug science, drug policy, drug law enforcement, all of those endeavors take place within the American context. And if you're within the American context, you have to think about our history of slavery, subjugation of certain groups, and why would anybody expect drug science or drug policy to be different from every other endeavor in our society? That is, why would anybody expect race not to play a role when you have humans participating in this endeavor?
Yeah. Could you give us an example of that? I mean, take a drug like heroin, or take a drug like marijuana. How did the racial narrative inform the way we deal with these drugs, even just starting historically?
Yeah, if we think about this historically, most Americans think drugs are banned because of the unique dangers they pose, because of their pharmacology. But when in fact, drugs are banned because good old American racism. Let's take cocaine, for example. At the turn of the 20th century, cocaine was legal in this country. It was in a number of products, including Coca-Cola. And then about late 1800s, actually, this occurred when Coca-Cola decided to bottle their product. Previously, it was only in the fountain drinks. And the fountain is Black people were not allowed to sit at the fountain and order drinks. And so Coca-Cola was primarily available only to white people. But when Coca-Cola decided to bottle it, now Black people had access to Coca-Cola. We started to see these stories appearing in the media, in the medical literature, connecting some heinous act or behavior to Black people and the use of cocaine. So they were claiming that Black people behaved inappropriately when they were on cocaine, so much so that we should be worried about Black men who are going to rape white women. And then they would tell stories about the cocainized Negro drug fiend who had taken cocaine. And then when the sheriff unloaded his .32 caliber weapon into this person's heart, this person continued to come at the sheriff and attack the sheriff. Stories like that led to Southern police forces to move to a higher caliber weapon. And these stories also contributed to the federal government banning drugs like cocaine and opium-based products. Those were the first laws that were passed in 1914. Before that, passing a national law to inhibit or to prevent drug use was unheard of. But these stories of Black people and also Asian people with opium, these stories of these undesired groups using psychoactive substances were enough to encourage Congress to pass legislation restricting access to these drugs.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Carl Hart about his book, Drug Use for Grown-Ups. He is a neuroscientist and a professor of psychology at Columbia University. Yeah, so now to the war on drugs, which you've just introduced there. You say that the war on drugs hasn't been a complete failure. It's only failed to rid us of drugs. So in what way has it not been a failure?
Yeah, the war on drugs, a number of people in our country are fond of saying that the war on drugs has been a failure. It has not. Otherwise, it would not be continued decade after decade after decade. The war on drugs currently functions as a sort of a jobs program. The war on drugs, every year we spend about $40 billion to support this war. And the bulk of these funds go to law enforcement agencies, go to prison authorities. And so those industries are always hiring, and the war on drugs allowed them to do so. And there are industries like hotels and restaurants that are near prisons where loved ones of the inmates have to frequent these businesses. And so when we are arresting, for example, 1.5 million Americans every year for simply possessing drugs, it's in the service of this war on drugs, and it's also in the service of those industries who are making money on the war on drugs. So for them, the war on drugs has been a boon.
So now let's go back to the Declaration of Independence. I found this such an interesting way that you use this concept. You know, you talk about the foundation of liberty is a pursuit of happiness. That's what really is kind of enshrined in our Declaration of Independence. And you apply it to your approach to taking drugs. Connect the dots.
Yeah. One of the things that I was forced to do in the course of writing this book is to look at the founding documents of this country. And the Declaration of Independence, I was struck by because of the profound, noble ideas articulated in it. And it's a short document. But number one, or chief among them, is this idea that every American citizen has by birthright at least three important rights: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It simply means that we can live our life as we see fit, so long as we don't prevent others from doing the same. And then the very next sentence, it says that government should be created to secure these rights, not restrict them. And so that's inconsistent with how we have been handling drugs in this country and people's desire to alter their consciousness. And so I know the Declaration is not law. That's the thing that makes it so beautiful. It's the ideal, and it's the ideal towards which we are striving. And I wanted to remind people that this is what it means to be American. That is, being able to live your life as you see fit, so long as you don't bother others or prevent others from doing the same. And so when we think of drug use in that context, it seems that drug use, personal drug use, is a protected right that the government seems obliged to secure and protect. But we have not lived up to the promise, or our practice is not consistent with our promise. So I hope that helps the reader to challenge, think about this and other activities or other inconsistencies in our society.
And I can imagine, you know, the people may say, well, but drugs cause a lot of harm. I mean, I personally remember when a kid in my son's high school class died of an overdose. I mean, we have hundreds of thousands of people who have died from drug overdoses. Talk about heroin in particular. Now, I know that you use heroin. You speak about it in the book. You also say that somebody in a clinic in Geneva, Switzerland, told you that heroin is one of the safest drugs there is. So tell us, why are so many people dying from it if this is so safe?
Yeah, thank you. There's a lot to unpack in that question. First of all, one of the things I try to do in the book is I try to re-educate the reader in terms of what they've been told about drugs like heroin. So when we think of heroin, heroin and morphine are essentially the same drug. Heroin is morphine with two acid groups attached to it. And those acid groups don't really do anything biologically. So heroin is essentially morphine. Morphine comes from the opium poppy. So does opium and codeine. And so heroin is just another opioid. Now, can people get addicted to heroin or other opioids? Absolutely, yes. Just like they can get addicted to alcohol. And so when we think of heroin, however, we think of heroin as being uniquely more dangerous than all these other drugs. And that's a fallacy. And I'm trying to show the reader that most of the dangers associated with heroin comes from the fact that the drug is illegal and obtained from illicit markets. That is, the heroin that's obtained illegally oftentimes is tainted. The quality varies widely. You don't know if you're going to get 5% heroin or 80% heroin, which makes it a dangerous proposition because you might take too much, thinking that you have a lower concentration of heroin. And you also are exposed to a world in which you have to be paranoid, paranoid about the police, paranoid about the people with whom you are interacting. All of these sort of conditions increase the dangers of heroin, but these dangers are not the drug itself, but it's the conditions which we have created by forcing people to be underground with their heroin use. We've created these conditions by stigmatizing heroin use so much. And now the goal here is not to encourage people to take heroin. The goal here is to help people to step back and evaluate what's really going on. When we think about heroin overdoses, for example, overdoses from opioids that we typically think of, OxyContin, morphine, heroin, overdoses from a single opioid is kind of difficult to do. There are few of those cases. Most people who overdose from what people have termed heroin overdoses, they have overdoses because they combine heroin or some other opioid with another sedative, like an antihistamine, like promethazine, or like with alcohol, or like with a benzodiazepine, like Xanax. When you combine heroin or other opioids with other sedatives, you increase the likelihood of respiratory depression. And so I'm trying to help the reader to understand that. And hopefully people would be less likely to mix opioids with other sedatives. And but this kind of information isn't generally provided to the public. Another reason that people die from what we have termed a heroin overdose is that they get tainted drug. That is, they may think they have heroin when in fact they have a more potent opioid like fentanyl or a fentanyl analog. And if they take fentanyl in the same amounts that they usually take their heroin, it increases the likelihood that they will overdose because fentanyl is so much more potent, that is, requiring less amount to produce an effect. It is so much more potent than heroin, it increases the likelihood of overdose. And so one way we can deal with that simple problem is to make sure that we have these drug checking facilities where people can submit small samples of their drugs anonymously and receive a chemical printout of what the drug actually contains. And if it contains a contaminant that's potentially dangerous, you don't take it. But this information or these services are not available in the United States. They are available in Europe, in places like Spain and Austria, the Netherlands, and even Colombia. And so these things that people think are problems of heroin or related to heroin, it's not. It's these other issues that occur as a result of our draconian drug policy.
Carl Hart, in this book, In Drug Use for Grownups, you challenge the notion that regular, what you call responsible drug use, causes brain damage. This is a common idea for, you know, a lot of drugs. But what about the impacts of drugs on growing brains, on adolescent brains? I mean, for example, cannabis or alcohol. I mean, I have seen a lot of studies that say that they impact the brains of adolescents that are growing so quickly. So I wonder if you could address that.
Yeah, so when people asked questions like, do drugs change the brain or the functioning of brains? Of course, this conversation changes the functioning of my brain. And if there is some sort of learning here, it's going to change permanently. The real question is, do drugs change your brains in a pathological manner? And so far, the evidence that we have regular, typical recreational drug use, there is no evidence to support that the notion that drugs alter people's brains in a negative way in a long-term fashion. And I go through the evidence to show people this. But people ask the question also, what about on the developing brain? That's a good question. We never ask that question, by the way, when we administer to children attention deficit disorder medications like amphetamines or antidepressant medications or medications to treat asthma. All of these medications we give to children who may be afflicted with one of these disorders. But we never ask that question. One of the things that's important to understand that is that we make sure we attend to the dose when we give a drug to a child. We make sure we cut the dose to be lower than that of someone who is an adult or someone who weighs more. The same can be true when we think about marijuana use on an adolescent's brain. The book doesn't really deal with adolescents, but this notion that drug use negatively alters brain functioning on the developing brain, there is almost no evidence to support that statement. And in the book, I go through how so-called neuroscientists mislead the public with statements suggesting that the drug use is negatively altering the brains of users. And this is a delicate issue because there might be evidence that's generated in the future that actually shows that. But at this moment in our history in 2021, there is virtually no evidence to support such statements.
Carl Hart talking with Writer's Voice in 2021. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the rest of that conversation. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Our show notes are at writersvoice.net, where you can listen again or delve into our show archives. Read interview transcripts at the Writer's Voice Substack, and don't forget to subscribe. It's free. As always, I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.